Good morning, please be seated. This is Bowman versus State, 67656. Please make sure you make your appearances on the record. Counsel, if you're ready.
Thank you. Teresa Restenhart, Restenhart Law, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Federer.
Please come to the podium.
Ms. Ristenberg, before we get started, could I ask just a couple questions? We spent a lot of time going through this record, and I'll admit it just because of the issues are kind of different in this case, but we couldn't find a copy of the jury instructions. Do you know if they were transmitted as part of the record on appeal?
They were not part of the record on appeal.
Okay, because it was fast-tracked original?
Yes, fast-tracked, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Why does that make a difference?
For the jury instructions?
Yeah.
I believe because one of the clear issues in here is that we are arguing that it is plain error that the trial judge failed to actually instruct the jury from prohibiting or from refraining from doing independent investigations and or experiments. And so a look at the trial record shows that the trial judge never instructed the jury as part of the stock admonishment. And there was no specific jury instruction, which we could put in as a
And thank you for raising that, because I want to hear from Mr. Plater on that, because I was very concerned about that, because we went through the whole opening charge to the jury, the closing charge, the admonishments. Mm-hmm. We didn't, as you said, we didn't have the jury instructions, but we did not see anywhere in the record where the court instructed the jury they could not do independent experiments or research. So if that's incorrect, I hope Mr. Plater can clarify that for us.
Correct, sir. Okay. Your Honors, Mr. Bowman's conviction needs to be overturned for the two reasons. One is the prejudicial misconduct by the jurors performing out of control and out of court independent investigations that directly deal with material facts in dispute. In fact, the only issue in dispute in this case. In addition, because the trial judge's failure to admonish or to instruct the jurors that they were not to do their own independent investigations. Turning to the first issue as to the prejudicial misconduct. Here in this case, the only fact in dispute was whether Mr. Bowman possessed the drugs, or more specifically, where did the drugs come from? The state's theory is that the drugs were secreted away on Mr. Bowman, either in his waistband or in his sock or clothing, and somehow shooken loose during the intake by the deputy at the Washoe County Jail. The defense theory was that a very young, new deputy inadvertently trekked the drugs on into the intake room on the bottom of his work boot, where then it was dropped off while he was searching Mr. Bowman. Those investigations that two different jurors did when they broke at night to go home, after being deadlocked for almost a little bit over 3 hours on a trial where the entire evidentiary portion was 3 hours and consisted of three witnesses, shows that the jurors had, at least those jurors, had some doubt as to each of the theories. One went home and placed a small baggie full of sand into a sock, his sock, and tried to work it loose. The other juror went home and took a small baggie, filled it with sugar, and tried to step over it with his construction boot in order to see whether it would stick to the construction boot. That juror's independent investigation went directly to dispute the defense theory in this case.
Now, what happened afterwards, and correct me if I'm wrong, is when this issue came up and those jurors signed affidavits, Judge Hardy had an evidentiary hearing, and the jurors seemed to back off somewhat from that. Can you tell us about that and
correct,
what
Your
happened?
Honors. The state sent affidavits to three jurors who we believed identified as conducting experiments when we had conversations with them after the verdict had been reached in the jury room. And the state's affidavits, as you saw as part of the record, in those affidavits, the jurors are very clear as to the thought process when they disseminated the information, and also, in fact, that it changed at least one juror's mind based upon his experimentation, that he went back, told the other jurors, and then changed his vote. After the jurors sent their affidavits, the trial judge requested an evidentiary hearing, brought the jurors in before the jurors came in. They did have a meeting with the Washoe County District Attorney's Office investigator, and then when they testified, their memory was more hazy as to when the information was disseminated. But I think that you can look at the timing of the record, and specifically...
So they indicated they did do the experiments, but the question, they were hazy or how it came into the negotiation process.
Correct.
Okay.
And because the record is muddled, I do believe that it should go in the favor of the appellant at this stage. But I think what, again, the telling point is they were deadlocked for 3 hours, and they come back after conducting these experiments. At some point, this information is disseminated because both jurors did say they told the other jurors, and they have a guilty verdict within 20 minutes.
So was the timing established that they told the other jurors before the jury voted to return guilty verdicts?
In their affidavits, it was established that they told the other jurors their experiments, and then they took another vote. When they came in to testify before the court, they then became more hazy as to when the exact timing was. In addition, besides the timing, is the fact that the experiments go directly to the materiality of the issue of the case, very similar to these court's holdings in Meyer and in Thacker, where it is the issue in the case, in fact, the sole issue in this case, as to whether or not the drugs were carried in on the boot or were they dropped by Mr. Bowman.
Why should we not give deference to the ruling of the district court judge, though, after hearing this?
Pursuant to Meyer versus State Justice, that a de novo review of the trial court's conclusion regarding the prejudicial effect of any misconduct is appropriate when it pertains to extraneous out-of-court information. That is what occurred here. They went home, did experiments, which is uncontrolled, and also out of court, and then they brought it back to the jury room. So we'd be asking for a de novo review. In addition, at least on its very face, justices, is prejudicial. That's clear that it's prejudicial that at least these two jurors were not sure of their opinion. They go home to conduct experiments either proving or disproving the state's or the defense theory. And they are clearly admonished. And in fact, in this case, they were admonished because the trial judge read the stock admonishment, which includes the language that they are not to form or express any opinions. And they go home to conduct experiments to form or express an opinion before coming back and waiting to deliberate with the rest of the jury. Based upon
isn't
all...
That admonishment, that's normally done while the trial's taking place, though, isn't it? Not to form or express an opinion. I think they can give opinions in jury deliberations, but probably not from extraneous experiments is the problem.
Correct. And in fact, Judge Hardy went further in his admonition that night while breaking and in fact stated, do not form or express any opinion while you're broken for the night in deliberations. Come back tomorrow and we'll start anew. So based upon all that, the appellant conviction, Mr. Bowman's conviction, needs to be overturned based upon the prejudicial misconduct by the uncontrolled experiment out of court conducted by these jurors, two different ones.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Simpart. You know, when we get these records on appeal, and here's an example, I know both of you do a lot of appeals and all, normally the court reporters or the court recorders don't take down the judge reading the jury instructions to the jury because theoretically they're a separate document and they're going to be forwarded as part of the record on appeal so we can look at them here. In this case, we didn't have it. But since it was presented, they were read to the jury, was there any jury instruction read to the jury saying you cannot do any independent experiments or research when the standard instructions were read off before the jury deliberation started?
To my recollection review of the record, no. But I am happy to supplement this court's record in providing those jury instructions that
well, way. I mean, if you and Mr. Plater agree, then I guess we can take your representations. If there's a dispute on that issue, that's what we were trying to find out, since we don't have the benefit of the instructions here.
But no, according to my recollection of hammering out the jury instructions, there was no jury instruction.
Okay, thank you.
In addition, justices, beyond the prejudicial misconduct that warrants a new trial and a reversal of the conviction for Mr. Bowman, this case is a vehicle for this court to reaffirm to the lower courts that in addition to NRS 175.401, that they must also advise in criminal cases that jurors are not to do independent investigation, research, or experimentation. And in fact, this is an opportunity for this court to possibly reexamine the stock admonishment in NRS 175.401 and whether it needs to be updated to reflect our current culture, society, and technology.
Well, since this is a statute, you know, it's up to the legislature writing the statute. We can't rewrite the statute, but if we were judicially going to modify that acknowledgement through judicial procedure, what would you recommend it say?
I believe that the 10th Circuit Federal Court has an excellent instruction that has been incorporated and used. It is not part of the record, but I have seen it in other cases where they use very layperson language. And I do have a copy here. And in addition, which I'm happy to read portions of it to you, it is the 10th Circuit Instructions for Use During Trial, 2.01 out of the 10th Circuit. Do not conduct any internet research or consult with any other sources about this case, the people involved in the case, or its general subject matter. You must keep your mind open and free of outside information. Only in this way will you be able to decide the case fairly, based solely on the testimony, evidence presented in this courtroom, and my instructions on the law. If you decide this case on anything else, you will have done an injustice. It would be a violation of your oath to have based your decision on someone else's reporter's view or opinion or upon information you acquire outside the courtroom. And also, it could be an opportunity for some guidance for trial judges that, in addition to a stock admonition, and also including specific language that they're not to conduct investigation or experiments outside of court, that trial judges should be encouraged to give current examples that reflect society at that time.
Counsel, sadly to say, that has been the discussion of some continuing education for our district court judges statewide over the last few years, especially with the use of cell phones and things of the like and internet research. And I hate to say, because it shows age, but even before I came to the bench here, that was being discussed. So that goes back over 12 years.
Understood. And this is a very tough situation because a juror's job is not easy. We take them from their everyday life and ask them to make incredibly difficult decisions about an individual's actions.
Well, we have an expert on that issue since Justice Gibbons was able to serve on a criminal jury in Carson City.
First-hand experience as to taking people out of their normal everyday situation and putting them in a very difficult job. So the more guidance we can give trial court judges and jurors themselves, I think the more fair and impartial trial can be. As for Mr. Bowman's case, based upon the prejudicial misconduct of two different independent jurors doing an out-of-court and controlled investigations, coupled with the plain error of the trial judge failing to instruct the jury to not conduct these types of experiments, the appellant's conviction should be reversed. I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Before you sit down, I'm still the issue of Judge Hardy's ruling, because in his last full paragraph, he says, the court can find no reasonable probability the verdict was affected because the evidence before it is that the independent experiment did not change the votes of the jurors who conducted them, and the result of the experiments were not broadcast to other jurors. So he specifically found that it didn't change, allegedly, the votes of the jurors who conducted those experiments. How should we read that or not read that?
Correct, Your Justice. I do believe, though, that Judge Hardy failed to actually look at and use the Meyer standard, which is whether this extraneous information would affect a reasonable hypothetical juror. He was focused on whether it changed these jurors' minds.
At the evidentiary hearing, were all 12 jurors interviewed or just,
no,
just the two?
Just the two. That was it. And I can submit to you firmly that if a juror came back and said, well, I tried walking over a plastic baggie full of sugar, which looks a lot like methamphetamine in my layperson opinion, and it didn't stick, that that would have a definite effect upon the reasonable hypothetical juror in a case where the sole issue was it trucked in on the boot by the young deputy, or was it falling out of his clothes, meaning the appellant's. So based upon all that, I believe that it was an incorrect ruling and the motion for a new trial should have been granted. And it was based upon all the above reasons.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of the state.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Plater. I represent the state of Nevada. I think this case boils down to the issue of whether Judge Hardy could rely on the jurors' testimony at the evidentiary hearing, and if he found their testimony to be true, whether he could use that testimony to deny the motion for a new trial. And then I think the next issue is, what's the standard of review for Judge Hardy's order in this court? The answer to the first question is yes, Judge Hardy could accept the testimonies that the jurors gave at the evidentiary hearing, could find that testimony to be true, and if he did, he could make the order that he did, denying the new trial. The standard of review in this court is that this court should give deference to the factual findings of Judge Hardy, and then the court can use a de novo review as to whether there was prejudice flowing from the factual findings that Judge Hardy made.
But what if we say the issue is failure to instruct? Did he instruct the jury at all?
He didn't, Justice Cherry. He gave, as the record shows, the standard admonishment during each adjournment that under the statute, I think it's 175.041, not to watch, listen, talk with anybody, don't form any opinions. He gave the standard statutory.
But when he did the opening charge to the jury after they're sworn, when you give them, here's how the trial's going to work, and you give that explanation, and the closing charge to them after the closing arguments are completed and jury instruction's been read, isn't that a time when maybe you should say that?
That'd be a great time to do it, I agree.
But the fact, I think Justice Cherry's point was, if he didn't do it, is that error that maybe led to these jurors doing this because they didn't know it was wrong to do it, and they did something that's clearly wrong, and that may cause us to have to reverse the case. So what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think if you take that position, what you're saying is it's structural error. It's reversible error per se not to have the instruction, and that's going to overturn a lot of this court's case.
But it isn't structural because they did it. In other words, if they didn't do it, if it was just an issue that he never instructed them and they never did anything, there's no issue there. That would be structural error. Yeah. But this is not structural error. This is actual error where they did an experiment. I'm amazed that wasn't handled a little differently by the district court judge.
What I meant by the term structural error is that there were the failure to instruct the jury not to perform outside investigation would result in prejudice per se, that it's prejudicial per se. And that's not what this court has said should occur when there's extrinsic influence.
Appellants seem to say that the affidavits are a little different than when they brought before the judge. And I can understand a juror being hesitant when you're brought before a judge to testify that you don't want to sound like a complete fool. And I think that's why maybe they hedged a little bit on their testimony. And then Judge Hardy just jumped on that, which I don't think is correct.
You're right. The affidavits from the jurors are completely different than what they testified to at the hearing. So I think that poses the question, what's Judge Hardy supposed to do at this point? These affidavits were filled out before the evidentiary hearing. They were filed with the court. Judge Hardy saw them. He saw the motion for new trial.
But the district attorney investigator also talked to these jurors.
Right. That's on the record. I think it was Investigator Mary Doyle.
Sounds like a right out of Blue Bloods or out of Law and Order, this case.
Mm-hmm. So, but what's Judge Hardy supposed to do when he gets these affidavits and then he has an evidentiary hearing and then these two offending jurors come and testify when they give testimony that directly contradicts their affidavits? What's the function of the trial court judge at that point? We submit that it is what exactly Judge Hardy did in this case. He looked at their oral testimony in court, he found it to be true, and he fashioned an order after that testimony. That's within his province as a trial court judge. That's what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to determine whether these witnesses are credible or not, and that's what he did. Mm-hmm. And when he found that their testimony was credible, he found that there was no prejudice to the defendant because, number one, according to the testimony of the jurors, the investigation they did occurred after they had already formed their opinion that the defendant was guilty, and it was based on the fact that they testified they never told any other juror about their investigations. And when they did reveal it, it was after the verdict had been signed and given to the foreman.
The concern when you talk in terms of credibility, if they had formed that opinion that this in fact happened, what was the need to conduct an experiment?
Nobody asked them that, Justice Cherry. Well, why did you do it? It's our position it wasn't proper. It shouldn't have been done. The question really is one of prejudice, and that's what Judge Hardy addresses in his order. He never addresses whether it was improper. I think implicitly he probably found that, or at least, I mean, we'll take the position it wasn't proper to do what they did. But if you accept the factual findings that Judge Hardy made, then I think this court's standard of review is to give deference to those factual findings. And I agree with counsel when she says, well, the standard of review is de novo in terms of prejudice. What that means is this court should give deference to Judge Hardy's factual findings, and then we should say if those findings are supported by substantial evidence, which I think they are because the two jurors testified, what would this court's de novo conclusion be regarding prejudice? And I think, obviously, our position is there is no prejudice because both the jurors said they thought this man was guilty before they performed their experiments, and they only divulged the results of their experiments after the verdict had been completed and given to the jury foreman. So,
Mr. Player, I assume you agree with opposing counsel that in the jury instructions, which were read to the jury, that nowhere did it say not to do any independent research or experiments.
I'm having trouble with an independent recollection. I remember going through the jury instructions, and I think it's my recollection that's not there.
Okay.
That's different. We'll supplement the record. It wasn't there, as I recall.
If you could, if it's okay with Justice Douglas, since we don't have them, that may bear on our decision.
The argument that Judge Hardy used the wrong standard in his order, counsel seemed to suggest just a few moments ago that he used a subjective standard and not the objective, hypothetical, reasonable juror, how they would perceive this type of information if it came to them. And I don't see that in Judge Hardy's order. The last paragraph, in fact, says, if you look at his order, he set out the applicable standard, right? It's the Meyer standard. The court is referred to a number of times. He set out the proper standard. And in fact, Meyer, going back to you, Justice Cherry, Meyer reminds us that not every instance of extraneous influence on a jury or a juror is presumptively prejudicial. In fact, most times it probably won't be. And so the standard that the trial judge has to ask and resolve is a reasonable probability of prejudice once misconduct has occurred. Anyways, in the last paragraph of Judge Hardy's order, he said the court can find no reasonable probability the verdict was affected. I think that he's using a reasonable hypothetical juror standard there. Even if he wasn't, if you give deference to the facts that he's found, I think you'd have to find there was no prejudice, according to what these jurors said under oath.
at the evidentiary hearing. So, again...
I assume your opposing counsel is going to say that if she agreed with the standard, that the findings may be clearly erroneous. What's your comment on that?
Well...
Based on the totality of the record with the affidavits saying one thing and the testimony being different. I mean, it's not like there were no affidavits. If they were just called in and they said, look, this is what happened, that's one thing. But here you got conflicting sworn statements, the testimony in court with the affidavits.
Realize that the very first person who testified at the evidentiary hearing, I'm trying to remember which juror it was, the first one who testified... And they both had conflicting affidavits, but he was never presented with his affidavit at the evidentiary hearing. In other words, Bowman's counsel never approached that juror and said, well, wait a second, you said this. You said the exact opposite in your affidavit. What's going on here? So he was never really called upon to resolve the apparent contradiction, okay? Now, she did approach the other juror and said, but you said something different in your second, or in your affidavit as opposed to the testimony we're hearing today. And he explained it. And this is why it's important to give trial judges deference in their factual findings. He said, you know, I looked at my affidavit again. When I found out that there was going to be a hearing on this issue, I looked at it, and I realized that maybe I misunderstood a few things. My affidavit wasn't correct. So he said he approached the investigator, I think it was Mary Doyle, and... He said, my memory is different now. I remember it differently now that I've reviewed my affidavit.
Were these affidavits part of the record?
I'm sorry?
Were these affidavits made
yes.
part of the record?
Yeah, they're part of the record on appeal. They're in here. I think.
Yes, they're.
I remember reading them.
Yeah, they're in the record.
Yeah. So, but again, what's a trial judge supposed to do? So I guess what I'm saying is it's not... They really didn't get that much of a chance to answer anybody's questions. Well, why did you give these statements in your affidavits, and now you're giving us different testimony here in the courtroom? That wasn't really resolved. But let's assume that you're a trial judge and you get these two conflicting statements. Isn't it your duty to, in resolving the motion, to make a determination which one's true and which isn't? I mean, you got to determine which statement am I going to rely on, which one's true. I think that, and that's what he did. You know, the issue of determining credibility by a trial judge, I'm not suggesting it's easy. I think it'd be very difficult in some circumstances when a witness is telling the truth. But, you know, they rely on a lot of different things, and you know that. Having been in the district court and trial judges, when you see a witness, you look at the witness and you evaluate their credibility on their demeanor, the way they look, how they talk, their speech patterns, their education, how they come across. There are a lot of things that a trial judge, I think, relies on that aren't necessarily always reflected by the record. I don't see any clear error by Judge Hardy when he says, in essence, I accept your testimony that you gave to me today. And that's why we think the judgment of conviction should be affirmed.
Counsel, even though you did not submit a reply brief, we'll give you 2 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice. I do agree with Mr. Plater on one thing, is that trial judges do need a lot of guidance. And directives from this court as to jury instructions that they must give is imperative. In this case, there was a reasonable probability, based upon the totality of the facts and circumstances, the split vote, as referred to in the affidavit, which is in Joint Appendix 3.
Counsel very specifically asked the affidavits and the Bowman affidavit, was it provided to him? Was he asked about it? How did this come into play?
The affidavits?
Yes.
The state was directed by the trial judge to prepare affidavits that would be then sent out to three jurors who had indicated, or that we believed in our remembrance of our conversation, to have conducted experiments. We were unsure as to which juror one was. We remembered numbers, not names. And therefore, the state sent these out. They were affidavits consisting of approximately 5 pages with a host of questions. One being, did you conduct an experiment? If so, what was it? What did it consist of?
So the bottom line is the state prepared these affidavits, not the defense.
Correct. And in addition, they were notarized, and they were sworn affidavits.
Mr. Bowman, well, what's in here is we have a notarized affidavit on behalf of Mr. Bowman.
Your Honor, you may be looking at my defense counsel motion for a new trial.
Well, that's...
There was an affidavit that I submitted as part of the record for the motion for a new trial based upon what had happened in the jury room. And if you refer to...
Well, that's what I'm trying to get down to. We have this motion for a new trial. We're stuck with this issue. We're dealing with the finding of the trial judge and trying to reconcile whether that affidavit or, as counsel has asserted, the judge's credibility finding. So I'm looking at that affidavit and says, was, say, Mr. Bowman, was he queried about the secondary affidavit that you submitted or not? Or was it just an argument that took place in front of the judge?
Are you referring to the affidavit by the juror? Because there is no affidavit by Mr. Bowman, the appellant. He's the defendant.
No, she's not, yeah, excuse me, yes, Mr. Bowman, but the individual who said that he changed his vote.
And that would be Juror Nielsen.
Yes.
I did actually inquire as to one of the jurors, and I do believe it was Juror Nielsen, as to, well, you stated in your affidavit this, and now you're coming in today and you're stating this. And his response, to my recollection, was, well, I've had time to think about it more, and my memory is a little hazy about when I told everyone. But that's what I'm saying today, is that I remember, I think I told them after we'd already voted. And again, that was after already discussing with the Washoe County District Attorney Investigator and assumingly being informed that what they had done was wrong, because they had not been informed of that before, because there was no jury instruction. Thank you.
Thank you for the arguments this day. Interesting issue. It points us back to the fact that we need to have proper admonishments given to jurors. With that, this matter will stand submitted. Thank counsel for the briefing and the argument.